Welcome to the Monday Minute. These shows are normally just kind of informal, what's going on, what's timely updates from Steve and I. Steve's actually out hunting today, but didn't want to leave you guys without a Monday Minute this week and thought of the perfect thing to share with you, speaking of timely, an episode that we have done previously on hunting elk post-rut and in the late season. So as we're in mid-October now and kind of making that transition post-rut, later season hunts upcoming soon, wanted to share an episode we released a couple of years ago on this very topic to give you guys some ideas about how you might change your tactics for post-rut late season elk. As I'm sure you're aware, you know, most of the talk with hunting tactics for elk is focused on September, it's focused on the rut, it's focused on breeding, it's focused on bugling. And a lot of that can go out the window when you're hunting later in the year. So this episode should help you out. Again, it's something we recorded a couple years ago, but still timely information for today. The guest that we interviewed on this topic is Mark Kaiser. He's a hunting author and does a lot of late season elk hunting himself. So this week, bonus episode, a replay, late season post-rut elk tactics with Mark Kaiser. Well, Mark, thanks for joining us tonight. How are you?
I'm good. How are you tonight, Mark?
Very good. So we were just kind of chit-chatting before we got the show started. You're getting ready to take off on essentially a month-long adventure to chase some whitetails through a handful of different states, but I'd love to just kick off this show to hear how your fall's been thus far. What have you got a chance to get out and chase?
So far this fall, I started out archery hunting pronghorn in mid-August. Yeah. And then I moved into archery elk, and then I moved into helping some friends with firearm antelope, and then I shot a muzzleloader mule deer, and now I'm got some more friends out, so we're chasing mule deer and antelope again. So
busy man, busy man.
So I've had a great season.
I was going to say, did you get success on most of those hunts there?
On every hunt except we ran back to Montana. With a couple of my friends for 2 days. It was a real brief hunt, and I tried to get them on some elk during the firearm season, and we just couldn't catch up with them. They had really changed their pattern mm-hmm. since bow season, and I needed more time to find the elk, and we just didn't have it.
Yeah, 2 days is tough.
It's super tough. These guys just run tight schedules, and I hoped and prayed we'd get into them, but apparently I didn't pray enough. So
yeah. So where did you archery hunt for elk? Was that at home in Wyoming for you, or were you somewhere else?
I started out in Wyoming, right here in my backyard in the Bighorn Mountains. I live just outside of Sheridan, Wyoming, between the town and the foothills of the Bighorn Mountains. So literally I can be elk hunting in 15 minutes if I want to be.
Wow. Wow.
And I tagged out. I can be there, so I had a good hunt there.
That's awesome. I could be elk hunting in about 15 hours if I drive really fast.
Really fast and take a couple 5-hour energy drinks, right?
Yeah. So I'm just kind of curious, just because I'm always love to hear seasons. You tagged out on the 8th, you said?
On the 8th of September. And the unit I was hunting is one of the lowest success units in Wyoming. But I usually hunt it because I can always get a tag. And it sounds odd that Wyoming, as a Wyoming resident, I have a tough time getting a tag in great units. But Wyoming residents don't get preference points. Non-residents like you do. So you can kind of build your preference point. And you can plan. I'm kind of in a random draw every year. But, I mean, when you live here and learn some of the, you know, the intricacies of the country and stuff, you can up your success a little bit, not always a lot, but it was a tough hunt. In 8 days of hunting, I heard 8 bugles, saw one giant bull, and I sat down to have lunch, and lo and behold, a bull elk walked right up.
So that's the one you tagged out on?
That's the one I actually spotted him from above. I was 500 feet above in some cliffs, and I saw him way below me, and he could hear me bugle. He answered me once, but the wind was picking up. So I dropped down off that cliff, dove through the thick timber, got down there, he was gone. And I was standing there on an open slope where he was, and back behind me where I'd just come through, I heard a cough. And I thought, gosh, that sounds like an elk. But it was 300-400 yards away. I looked around some more, no elk. So I went back in that dark timber. I couldn't find anything. But there was a series of benches in there. I found one nice bench without a sign. I thought, I'm just going to get above the bench where the thermals were rising. I sat down, had some snack, trail mix. I actually had seltzers there. I checked my texts and stuff. And then I always do this, and I'll be doing this whitetail hunting. I put an earbud in, and I listen to AM radio, you know, get news, just kind of break it up. But I only put one in. Uh-huh. And I leave the other out. And I was sitting there munching on trail mix, and I heard another cough. And I look over right beside me, and 20 yards away is that bull, is a bull elk stand.
No way.
And what he was doing, the reason he was coughing, so it was him from earlier, I'd heard. He was rooting around like a pig in the forest duff, and I think he was digging up mushrooms and eating.
Huh.
And he would get a snout full of dirt, and then he'd cough every so often. And he worked into about 12 yards. I mean, this is super thick timber. And he was straight on. I didn't have a shot. And finally, some other elk moved in. He was with a herd, and they come beside him, and he started quartering away and hit one little opening. I had just, you know how bow hunting is. It's just,
yeah.
just seconds and real brief windows, and I got an arrow off, and he tipped over right in front of me. It was cool.
That is awesome, man. So when you heard him in the cough, he was 20. He worked in just, you didn't do anything. I mean, you didn't call or make any... anything to draw him in. He worked into 12 yards.
Worked into 12, and then when I dropped the string on my Matthews pole, he was at about 29 to 30, I guessed. And I didn't have time to range. You know, when he
right.
just started moving with the herd, and he would hit little openings, and I was trying to estimate range and shoot at the same time. So it was fast and furious.
Yeah, man, that's cool. That's super cool. So we kind of jumped ahead, but I would love if you could give our listeners kind of just a background on who you are, how you were involved kind of in the hunting industry and things like that.
Well, I grew up in South Dakota, in eastern South Dakota, corn country. And my parents always owned land, had always owned a cabin in the Black Hills of South Dakota, which actually had elk and is like a little Rocky Mountain. So I just had this love for the West, and my parents took me out West. But my dad wasn't a big hunter. My grandpa was, but he was getting old, so he didn't take me out on big game hunting. We did pheasant hunting. So I'm kind of a self-taught hunter overall. I taught myself how to bow hunt, with a lot of bad habits that I've tried to fix over the years. So growing up in corn country, I love whitetails. But I also just had this bug for elk. About 10 years ago, I moved from central South Dakota, which has great deer hunting, great upland game hunting, waterfowl hunting. But I wanted to really get into the western hunting a little more, where I could do it every day, literally every day. And I wanted to go out and scout. So I moved to north central Wyoming, and lo and behold, I used to guide in eastern Montana, and so I'm real close to where I guided. I can be in Montana in a matter of 10 minutes if I really, you know, hit the gas on my truck, or I can be up in the mountains here in 15, 20 minutes. So I'm kind of in a great world. I have whitetails, mule deer, pronghorn antelope, all right in my backyard, literally, at times. I see elk from my front porch with my spotting scope. Sometimes we even have moose and bear walk right through my yard. So it's really a neat little piece of the world right here in north central Wyoming.
That's awesome.
And I'm a journalist. I went to journalism school, worked with the South Dakota Department of Tourism and Marketing and Public Relations, and then kept freelancing. I freelanced ever since I was in college, and I just decided about, I was close to 15 years ago now, I could make a living as a freelance writer, which when I said that, people thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
It's really a tough world, but
it is.
I'd done the math. I knew what I was making in my spare time, and I made it work. So I get a little bit of freedom. I work my butt off, literally in the summer, spring, in the winter, so I can have as much time as I need in the fall. And then in the fall, I'm blessed to work on a TV show, too. I do some episodes for Deer and Deer Hunting, which is on Sportsman's Channel right now. And next year, they're actually moving to Pursuit. So But I'm a co-host of, and on every episode I host, plus I hunt on probably a third or more of the episodes.
Yeah, very cool. Well, I first caught your name, I guess it's probably been at least 3 years ago now, but I was reading a issue of the Bugle magazine from the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and, you know, read an article, and a lot of times, I'll confess, I don't really pay attention necessarily to who's reading it, or to who wrote it, and I can't even remember which one it was, but I looked up, and it was an article that you had written, and I really enjoyed it, and then since then, there's been several more times where that's happened, I was like, oh, dang. Mark wrote that one too. So in addition to the Bugle, which I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with, you know, you mentioned freelancing, but just give us an idea of some of the other places that you write in terms of your hunting articles.
Well, the big one that a lot of people will see, and I have 3, 4, 5 articles a year in there, is American Hunter, which is the largest all hunting magazine out there right now, the NRA publication. This issue, there's a mule deer article, for instance. The previous issue, I had an elk article. I write for National Wild Turkey Federation, Turkey Country, and I write for their youth magazine, the Jakes. My son just graduated from high school, and I've had a lot of adventures with him, and my daughter is in high school yet, and her and I do a lot of outdoor stuff. So I really enjoy writing about youth and hunting and outdoor things. I write for Outdoor Life, Bow Hunter Magazine, Bow Hunting World, Bow Hunt America, North American Whitetail, Predator Extreme. I love coyote hunting. Every day in the winter, if I can, I go coyote hunting, and then I double it up with scouting for big game at the same time. Predator and Trapper, I write for them.
So needless to say, if somebody's listening to a hunting podcast, they've no doubt read one of your articles, whether they know it or not, because you've pretty much, you know, been
exactly
everywhere.
and online too. I write a lot of online stuff for some of these same sources, and Outdoor Hub. I do a lot of stuff with their online magazine.
Awesome. Very cool. So yeah, needless to say, I mean, you kind of mentioned you hunt nearly any species you can with nearly any method, nearly any time of the year. What I love to talk about tonight is, you know, post rut or late season, depending on how you find it. Define it, elk. And so right now as we record this, it's you know, the end of October, and there's some rifle seasons, you know, going on. Guys are getting ready for late archery, kind of depending on where you're at. And so, you know, as elk hunters, you know, most of us live for, can't wait for September, but there's still a lot of great opportunity out there now in this later season, as we speak in October, and even as we move into November. So, you know, the fun and all that and the rut is focused on September, but what are some of the advantages to start with that elk hunters can have hunting in this post-rut late season time of year?
Well, one of the advantages is snow. And if you're in elk country in most of the higher elevations, now some of the lower elevations in Arizona and New Mexico may not have that advantage, but snow gives you the advantage of finding tracks. Now, this time of the year, the elk can be very vocal in some areas, believe it or not. I've been in some bugle fests like you can't believe, right here in Montana next door, and in Wyoming, when these big herds start consolidating and getting together, there's still a lot of anxiousness amongst the bulls. It's not always the giant bulls. The big bulls may be on the edge of the herd. A lot of times right now they're starting to peel off and do their bachelor again, but when you get all these younger bulls together, they're just like teenagers, and you know, they got to show who's the toughest and who's the biggest.
You think some of that vocalization is still just kind of jockeying for position and things like that?
Yeah, and just being boisterous, you know, boys boisterous. So that's there can be some cows coming into heat. Usually around the middle of October, you get a real good blow up of bugling and herd activity and chaos again, and then it starts waning a little bit. But my biggest bull that I'm looking at right now that I took with a rifle I shot on Halloween, and he was with another giant bull and a bunch of cows, and they were just screaming at each other until about 1, 2 in the afternoon.
Really? That late in the day?
Yep. And then one of them broke apart, the one I shot, and he went off by himself. And we watched a little where he went into this little canyon. The other bull took off with the cows, and we heard him bugling as he left. You know, we went after the solo bull, and it took us a while, but we found him bedded. I shot him in his bed. He just stood up sleeping. So,
wow.
And about 5 years ago, I killed another bull, and I think it was the day before Halloween, up in Montana again. And that bull was screaming mad the day before, and I almost shot him. Then he come off a big cliff area, and I just couldn't get out fast enough to get on him. And then the next day, we kind of figured out where he was. Same thing. He was bugling. He was working up the ridge, and I set up and got a really nice shot on him. So,
yeah.
So be listening, and don't be afraid to bugle once in a while to maybe incite a little bit of response. But yeah. Back to the snow. Snow can reveal tracks, and tracks tell you where they're at. So always be on the lookout for tracks, because if they're not calling because of the hunting pressure, they have to leave tracks.
Right. Any tips for kind of assessing tracks in terms of freshness or just number of elk? Like, what are you looking for when you come across a track? What's kind of the process that you're thinking through?
I'm you know, if I'm hunting just for a bull, I don't care if it's a solo elk or a whole herd. In a whole herd, there's likely a bull in there. If it's a solo big track, it's likely a bull. And probably a bigger, more mature bull itself. And obviously the size of the track you need to look at. If it looks like a calf, like a cattle, calf, mm-hmm. Livestock calf size, then it's a cow or a calf. But if it's got that big, round impression, and it's by itself, it's generally going to be a bull. There won't be too many cows out just roaming by themselves. They're in their little herd groups yet, so... if you find it cut a fresh track, and I have done that before and walked an elk down in snow, falling fresh snow, I knew it was fresh track. I got on him, and I've done that before, walked right up on embedded bulls. Man, get on that track and go. And always look for the crispness, of course. Mm-hmm. You can, if it's a warm day and the track's melting out, it could have been made that morning and then melting out as the day went on. And like today here in Wyoming, it was nearly it got up to 65 degrees here, so on the mountain it was probably 50, at a high.
Right.
So any snow up there was melting.
Yeah. So at this time of year, it's typically the older bulls that are kind of breaking off from the herd first.
They're tired and they're wore down. The studies, when I look at deer stuff, and I equate a lot of this to elk, show that a mature buck will burn 20-25% of his body mass during the rut. And I have no doubt that equates back to elk, too. They have to be burning at least that. A whitetail, he's on the move trying to breed every doe he can. Well, a bull elk is on the move constantly trying to keep his harem together and keep the satellites out of the breeding scene. So if you watch a bull for a while, you just see they're just athletes, and they're just burning calories nonstop.
Yeah.
They're wore out. They're simply wore out. They've got to put mass back on. Again, going back to whitetails, if whitetails get over a 30% loss of body mass, they're nearing death. If they get over 33% on some of the research I've seen, they're basically dead or dying. Mm-hmm. So, again, I'm sure an elk is real similar to that. They cannot lose much more of that body mass, and they know winter's coming. And those older bulls, they do the same thing beginning. They kind of come into the rut a little late. They know, they've been there, done that. They know the cows aren't nestrous until a certain time. They know to conserve calories. And then at the end of it, they know they've done the most breeding. They kind of cut out, when they feel like most of those cows are bred and go back to revitalizing their body so they can live through the winter.
Yeah. Yeah, let's dive into food a little bit more here in just a minute. But are there any other insights you have into the mindset of an elk at this kind of stage in the game? I mean, you mentioned that obviously breeding's wearing down. They know winter's coming. They know food's important. Any other kind of clues into the mindset or things that would help us understand elk behavior and help our hunting? Or that's pretty much essentially it's just focus on getting that bulk back up and preparing for winter.
They're doing that, but they are definitely going into a refuge setting. With hunting pressure still on, they have to look for a an area where they can get security, not be bothered by hunters. They can get food, and they have access to food and refuge. Those are the two things. So what you're looking for in many areas are rough, remote canyons that are 1 to 2, 3 miles away from any road, or so rough that the average guy looks at it and says, I'm not going in there. So what I always look for is roadless, and again, 1, 2, 3 miles away from any road. I look for near vertical terrain that's just as silly steep as you can imagine. I look for south-facing slopes, and I look for a north-facing slope that they can navigate through to hold up in under thick cover, but still get to the south-facing slope quickly and easily. The other thing I look at when I'm hunting, so say you're not finding that, and here's what a lot of people come up with. This time of the year, the elk move to winter grounds, and many of those winter ranges are on private land. So what I try to do in that situation is I can't get permission, and it's just like it is, you know, in the Midwest and the West. It's hard to get permission anywhere. I try to find the public access next to good private land and hunt the fences or the fringes of that private land.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a point I wanted to bring up. You know, as elk are seeking feed, and the high country is getting more and more snow, and that feed's more covered, and, you know, the plentiful sources are lower, they're obviously going to be a greater chance that they're in these private land areas. So obviously bordering that is great on, you know, on the public land you can have access to, but how does that change your hunting tactics? I assume that in that kind of scenario, something like setting up for an ambush style hunt is a pretty good way to go.
What I would do in that situation is what happens is a lot of time these elk will feed on the private, but they'll retreat to the forest or some rough country nearby. Oftentimes the public to bed. So yeah, I look for an ambush, and you want to buffer that ambush because you don't want to deal with an angry landowner. So you don't want to sit right on a fence, right on a property boundary. You want to back up enough. So especially if you're hunting with a bow, you know, an elk can run easily 100 yards, even with a double long hip. But with a rifle, I'd say 100 to 200 yards minimum as well. Especially if you hit him right double long, he can still run just like his arrow shot if your bullet doesn't expand the way you hope it would. And I've learned a lot over the years. I use a certain type of bullet, and I'm always studying new bullets. But sometimes bullets and arrows do crazy things. So just give yourself plenty of room so you ethically are being a fair chase, a good hunter.
Yeah. So what are you looking for if you have, a patch of private abutted to a patch of public that you can have access to? You know, you mentioned fences and things like that, but in terms of either natural and or man-made funnels, like how are you trying to identify the areas that they are using if you haven't had a chance to pattern these elk?
One of the things you can look for, and you mentioned fences, is to walk the fence line and look for downed fence. Elk are notoriously lazy. In fact, they'll blow through a fence just as easily as they'll jump over. You want to find areas where they've broken off the top strand, and that's real common. In fact, ranchers, the average rancher is not a friend of elk because they're just hard and horrible on fences. Look for down fences because the elk will funnel to those areas to get over. They just don't want to jump. And then look for bottom lands. A lot of times those elk will start out leaving a field, and they'll go right up a canyon bottom, and then they'll begin sidehilling up to gain elevation. So look for those heavily used trails. And now this goes back to September, but I found this basin in Montana where I eventually filled my archery tag there. I stumbled across a trail that looked like cattle were using. And I followed that trail, and it led me right into a basin full of elk. So trails can reveal a lot. Trails with a few tracks, you know, there's elk there. Trails that look like, you know, the New York City Marathon just ran through there, that's what you want to focus on. Because even if the cows are using, putting most of the tracks down, you can bet that if it's a good food source, there's some bulls coming in and out of there as well, either leading or following that bigger cows.
Mm-hmm. This might vary, I'm sure, but what's sort of been your experience on the timing of elk moving between these feeding and bedding areas at this time of year, especially in this sort of private public area? I mean, is it something where they're essentially making the move to feed at night after dark? And then are they heading back into that security again before light? Or, I mean, has it been your experience that you've been able to catch them making those transitions during shooting hours?
It all depends on hunting pressure, how much pressure they're receiving. If they're hunted hard, like a whitetail buck is on 40 acres of land, they're going to do a lot of their movement pre-dawn and after dusk. They're going to do it, you know, right at the cusp of shooting light in either situation. Now, if you're hiking into an area, into a backcountry area, a couple, 2-3 miles in, hunting some big remote basins that see very little hunting pressure, maybe taking a horses in there, whatever, sometimes those elk will feed all day long. They'll be up on their feet in the middle of the day, just like cattle. And that's not uncommon either, that they'll be up and moving the middle of the day, then bed a little bit, soak up some sunshine, or head back into the timber, and then come back out onto the edge. So it really depends on just how hard they're being hunted. Hard pressured, act like whitetails. If they're in a real easy area where they're not pressured a lot, they act just like a cow down the road.
Okay. If you haven't identified or observed this travel funnel, say you're in a newer area at this time of year, and you're not hearing vocal activity, what's your go-to strategy? And is it any different from what you're doing in a similar situation in September when you're not quite sure exactly where they're moving and they're not talking, and so it's just tough to get on them? What's your kind of go-to plan?
Cover country. You just want to move. And the difference is in September, you can cover country and you can call and you can look for fresh bubs and stuff. In the post rut, like this time of the year, you got to cover country and use your optics, your glass, the opening you can. And you're looking, you may not see the bull, but if you see some cows, it looks like good winter range, then there's probably a bull nearby. And then the other thing I would note is all across the West, state and federal government have set aside elk winter range, designated elk, well, or wildlife range, where game can come down in the winter. There's no development, it's fenced off, and they can stage there. In many of these areas, and Wyoming included, and Montana, you can hunt those through a certain time period. So these elk show up on these designated winter ranges, and if there's a big dump of snow up high, those are good places to go because those elk are already pre-programmed to show up there and winter. So they may start bleeding in there, trickling in there. It may just be you may get run over there so much, but those are good things to watch. And then, as I said, watch that forecast. When snow gets to 18 to 21 inches, just shy of 2 feet, and this is research in Colorado, actually several states, when it gets to that 18 to 21 feet, or inches, 18 to 21 inches, elk don't like to be there anymore. And that's not if it dumps and melts. That's when it just kind of starts building up and staying. They will leave that country and move to easier grounds, which is their winter range. So say the snow's piling up, you're at 9,000 feet, and it's just staying there, and you got 2 feet of snow, odds are the elk have left there. You need to get in your truck, on your ATV, whatever, your horse, and move down the mountain another 2,000 feet probably to try and cut them off.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find that like a solo bull might hang out longer in that snow exposure than the rest of the herd?
Some do, but they do it in very unique micro environments.
Okay.
I know there's some research and some studies over in western Wyoming where that some of these bulls do winter at 9,000 feet, but they're wintering on slopes that are blown open because of the high winds, you know, just because of how this slope is situated. And it's got to be big enough to supply grass all year, but they'll stay up above 8,000 feet. Generally, elk are going, in my area, below 7,000 feet. Some areas, like where I just come out of Montana, that looks, from what I can tell, dropping down to 5,000. So, Yeah. Every area is a little different, just depending on how the elk have used it. And again, this private land situation is really, really transforms how elk move these days. Nowadays, these elk will leave 10,000 feet and drop down to 5,000 feet in 3 days because they know they can get to private land, stay there, and they'll do it before there's any snow.
Yeah.
So you got to be aware of those things too.
Right. It seems to me like in this later portion of the season, there's a greater chance on getting intel on kind of where the elk are at, whether they're at 5,000 or 7,500 or, you know, just kind of what their activity's been, where they've been spotted. Because obviously, the lower they come, the more they're sort of visible by the general populace. What are some of the ways that hunters can get intel on where the elk might be hanging out at this point in time? Like, who's the best people to talk to? Any sort of tips there?
Well, we were in Montana over the weekend, and we were in a little pub tavern eating, and I would just sat and was eavesdropping on everybody beside me, and that's how I was getting mine. So, you know, go to the convenience store, go to the restaurants, go to the pubs, the taverns, and sit and listen. And a lot of these old timers, they'll share information freely. And not only old timers, but hunters even. There's a lot of hunters out there. If you're in a convenience store and you see some guy in Blaze Orange or Camel, you know, go up and just say, hey, we've been having a tough time seeing elk. Do you know where a guy generally might find some, which area, you know, in the national forest? And those, a lot of these guys will share, especially ranch hands. It seems like those guys are more willing to share than maybe even hunters. But just don't be afraid to ask. You just never know. And I was just eating a sandwich, and I heard a lot what I needed to know the other night without even asking a question.
So maybe, though, if you're even kind of driving through the country and you see some guys out working on a ranch, maybe it's worth swinging by and trying to be friendly and hit them up for some info, right?
Exactly. And then, you know, the biologists in the area, they'll tell you where there's designated winter range, where these elk show up. They'll tell you where the majority of the elk winter. And that's their job to share that information. Now, they might not tell you the exact canyon, the exact coulee to go into, but they'll say, well, on the south slope over here, you know, 10 miles out of town, there's usually 100 head elk show up about this time of year. So game wardens are the same way. They're that's their job. Their job is to help you. Their job is to help wildlife. But don't be afraid to ask them. You and I all pay them for that job too. So
yeah. Yeah. Very cool. So are there any are there any calling strategies that you do use? I mean, we kind of mentioned that sometimes the elk can be vocal. But is there any ever a time where you were initiating things from a calling perspective? Or if you are in the vicinity of vocal elk, what is your strategy for being a part of that conversation, if any?
Yeah, my strategy, if I'm close to vocal elk, is to not be vocal.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter any time of the year.
If I was going to say, I would kind of like that in September as well.
Yep, same way. If they're talking, there's no need to butt in and add another person to it. So, yeah. But in the mornings, right at dawn, a lot of times I'll just do a lone bugle, not an aggressive bugle, more like a, hey, I'm kind of lost out here, anybody around type bugle.
So still a location strategy.
Exactly, yeah, and then okay. See if something responds to it. And then the same thing, if nothing responds to that, I go back to what I do in September. I just throw out the next call I do is a lone cow call, and I'll do a cat, like a lost calf call, because you just never know what a bull is going to respond to, or a cow. A cow may reveal the whole herd. She may answer, oh, you know, there's my calf I lost. Her calf might have got killed by a mountain lion or something. Who knows? But, you know, she may just answer to say, hey, we're all over here. And give away the whole herd. And you just never know. And then as far as calling, I hardly ever get real aggressive this time of the year just because the elk aren't aggressive. But there is a but there, and that is if the elk do, say a bull does start getting aggressive with you, I always try to match them. And I do the same thing. Let them lead the conversation. They start ramping it up, then I'll ramp it up. And that's how I killed my bull in Montana this year after I killed my Wyoming bull. I bugled at a bull way off across the basin, and one answered right below. you could just tell he was mad. Mm-hmm. And so I let him have it. I just said, my bugle said, "Hey, you're not the boss. I'm tougher than you." And he screamed back so fast, he cut me off. And then I knew he was coming. And so I started flanking him, trying to get down or keep the wind in my favor. And he was flanking me at the same time. And we met up in one little opening, and he didn't walk very far away after that. So
you won that battle, huh?
Well, me and my Matthews and my G5 Montech won that battle.
That's awesome. So, it covered, I think, a ton of excellent information on the elk, but just to get even more practical on tips for hunting at this time of year, it's obviously much different than hitting the mountains in September. What are some of your gear recommendations, strategies for staying warm, things of that nature when guys are hunting in the late seasons? The conditions get tough, and it's just kind of hard to sometimes put up with being out there when the conditions are hard.
Well, you always want to layer. You always want to bring enough layers. And I like these new lightweight jackets that have like a Microloft in it, or Primaloft, a Thinslate Ultra, things like that. They're very lightweight, very packable, and you just throw them on, take them off. You can add and subtract as you're hiking or as you're sitting, and they're great when you're sitting because you're going to do a lot of glass, and your whole key is to get up high and do glassing. The other thing I bring along is rain gear, and I call rain gear survival gear because not only does it keep you dry, whether it's raining or snowing, but it also breaks the wind. And if for some reason you'd fall down and twist an ankle and you can't get out of there at night, it's a huge bonus to conserving your heat. It traps your heat, and you can wrap yourself up in that. And then I'm a big, whether I'm whitetail hunting or elk hunting, I always carry a lot of hand and toe warmers and use them whenever possible. But something I think people overlook so much, covering your face. You've heard of the figure that about 30% of your heat goes out the top of your head, so you want to cover the top of your head. Well, your cheeks, your neck, your high cheekbones, your forehead, that's all the same thing. It lets out a lot of heat. So a face mask is another bonus that I do, as well as zipping up my collars. Always have high collars to grab the heat of your neck. And this past Saturday, we were in Montana, and it was supposed to rain. Well, the rain turned to snow where we were at, and we couldn't see 50 yards. It was snowing, blowing so bad. So I always carry not only the rain gear in my survival stuff, but I carry survival gear in my backpack and fire starting. So I just started a fire there, and we sat around a little campfire and warmed up, waiting for the weather to blow out. And by noon, it blowed out, and we could glass again. But that little fire was real nice. And where we were at, it was old burns and stuff. So smelling like smoke isn't that bad in the woods as maybe smelling like a pizza from the convenience store.
Yeah. What's your go-to kind of emergency fire starter kit? Anything in particular? Just basic tinder?
My buddies were amazed. I carry just any strike wooden matches. I keep them triple layered so they don't get wet. And then my go-to fire starter is dryer lint. I carry just a pile because it's lightweight and it ignites right away. And I got some pine needles going in that dryer lint, and we had a fire going in less than a minute. So
I do the same.
It was wet, so it was. But a magnesium, you seen those magnesium flints? They work great too. So don't overlook that stuff.
Yeah, I'll take dryer lint, and I mix in a little bit of petroleum jelly, Vaseline, and it kind of just extends the burn time on that a little bit. And that's like one of the best fire starter / tenders that I found.
Yeah, I always I just make sure I have that because I do so much solo stuff, and so far I've been lucky. I haven't gotten stranded out in the woods, but I definitely want to make sure I can stay warm and dry if something would ever happen. I couldn't get out and had to stay at night. So.
Yeah, for sure. So one thing I think, I don't want to say that most of us don't think of, I think quite a few of us have thought of it only because we've run into the issue, but maybe to save some newer hunters some trouble, guys don't necessarily plan ahead for if they're archery hunting late season, how these different layers might affect their shooting, whether that's they're wearing a face mask and so their anchor point's different, whether they're wearing a thicker, heavier jacket and it might interfere with the bowstring. Like, is that simply just a matter of practicing how you're going to be shooting in the real world, meaning bulk up with that gear and practice shooting and make sure that you're still shooting as effectively and things of that nature?
Exactly. And that's one reason. Now I'm switching to whitetails here within a few days. That's one reason why I carry a judo point in my quiver. So not only can I get up my tree stand and do the same thing out in the woods, you know, stump shoot in elk country, but I can make sure A, my bow is sighted in yet, you know, and then B, that this bulk of clothing isn't going to change my point of impact. And another thing I do besides practicing with all the clothes on is I wear a lot of compression items. So I got a compression sleeve I put over my left arm, so I'm right-handed, so it kind of tightens that bulky layer up. And then I wear, women archers have chest guard. I don't know if you've seen those. They're a mesh chest guard, and it's a compression guard for the compressor breasts of all things. So shooting, that doesn't, string doesn't slap there. And I have bought one of those, and I wear that when I'm hunting with a lot of clothes on too, and I just cinch that down, and it does the same thing. It just takes that layer of puffiness and presses it against my chest tighter, so my string.
Very cool. That's interesting. So while we're on the topic of shooting, you mentioned before that you're pretty particular in terms of your firearm setup and the projectiles that you're using and things like that. Walk us through your preferred setup for elk in terms of the firearm side of things.
I'm a big proponent of carry enough gun. So I think on elk, you know, people shoot elk with 243s, 6mm, stuff like that. And I don't have a problem with that as long as the shot angle's good. But elk are huge. They're just big-bodied animals, and they're tough. If you don't hit them right, you'll never find them. And so I like a 30 caliber, a 300 Win Mag, 300 Ultra Mag, 7mm Remington Mag. Those are ideal elk calibers. And I like to shoot enough bullet weight, too. So right now I'm shooting the Hornady Precision Hunter ammo, and they have a new bullet, the ELD X bullet. 200 grain, in my mind, is a perfect match for elk. It's hard hitting. This new bullet works really well if you're a long-range shooter designed to shoot at 600 and beyond, which in today's world with today's guns, you know, 500-600 yards isn't really a long shot if you practice it. You can do that. And then have a scope that gives you confidence. What I say in a scope that gives you confidence, that it has the long-range reticle, and I like the Nikon BDC. It's just easy to manipulate and use. But I like a lot of power too. You know, in the old days, everyone used a 3x9. And I like a 12, 16, and even better yet, a 20 or 22 power. When you've got an elk out there feeding at, say, 400 yards, and you crank it up to 16 or even 20 power, it fills that scope up. And if you got a good rest, that reticle gets solid, and you've got all the confidence in the world because you're looking at all hair and the reticle isn't bouncing around on a little mouse-like object out there.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on some of the traditional non-magnum calibers, but still in that 30 cal class, like, you know, a 308 or an .06 for elk?
Those are fine too. You know, and Jack O'Connor proved it time and time again with the 270. It'll kill elk. Those will work, and if you pair them with the right bullet, again, I have no problem with that. I just think when you get down a little lower than that, you're just taking a risk, and it's a risk really that it's not unethical, right, but it's just a risk, right, I think, that you don't need to take. You know, you invest a lot in an elk hunt. It's not like going out to your Uncle Fred's, you know, down the road and sitting in a whitetail tree stand and you got $5 in gas and Twinkie and a Coke. It's you know, $1,000 or more just to even get the tag in some places, and then $1,000 to get out there with lodging and all the specialized gear, backpacks and boots, and you know, you got several thousand dollars invested in elk hunt. So take a little time to get a rig that really shoots. And my rifle I'm shooting right now is the Bagara. I don't know if you've heard of Bagara barrels, but Bagara makes a rifle now, and they're a custom style rifle, even though it's a factory rifle, but it shoots a quarter, mine right now shoots a quarter minute of angle or less if I'm really, really not twitching. it's just a real fine shooting rifle, and it's under $1,000. It actually retails for $800. So.
Wow. That's impressive. Have you got into the ballistic side of things, like recommendations if guys are kind of looking at that, and like a minimum effective energy that you want to see at a certain range? I mean, you mentioned like taking a shot at 500, but that obviously gets back to the caliber question of how much energy does this projectile have at 500, whether you're talking about like, you know, a 300 Win Mag compared to the OT6, for example. They're obviously going to have different energy. Is there a recommendation that you like to see for elk?
You should never on big game, and especially elk, get below 1,000 foot-pounds of energy, in my mind, especially on elk, because you're hunting a critter that, if you got a big bull out there, even if he's lost a lot of weight over the butt, he could still weigh 700 to 800 pounds, depending on where he's living at. Migratory bulls are going to be a little less weight. Eastern Montana, some of those plains bulls there, they'll be 1,000 pounds going into the rut. So you need 1,000 foot pounds of energy. So whether your bullet is a 150 grain out of a 308, you know, and I don't have, forgive me, but I don't have the ballistic charts memorized on all these, yeah. But you do not want that bullet. So say he's at 500 yards or 700 or 800 yards, and it's a caliber where that foot pounds of energy falls below 1,000 pounds, maybe it's 600 pounds, foot pounds of energy where it's going to land at that distance. That's, that could be the difference between a kill and a wounding. So keep it above 1,000 foot pounds of energy, regardless of your caliber choice. And remember it, at, you know, because that foot pounds of energy drops dramatically with range. It's just like the bullet trajectory drops, so does the foot pounds of energy, especially once you get out past 600 yards.
Right, right. Man, great information. Love it. I would love to hear, Mark, after all these years of hunting, and then all the species, everything that you have experience with, you know, the journey kind of never ends in terms of hunting, which is a good thing. I think that's what keeps us coming back year after year, season after season. But what's something, a lesson that you're still learning or something that you are focusing on to improve your hunting even now?
With elk or deer, you're always learning, but I'm really learning a lot more about elk. And what I'm learning about elk is that it's like during the rut can be crazy, crazy. But I found one of the things I've learned the last couple of years is the last week of September, in fact, the last 3 or 4 days of September, sometimes can be your best on those big, big bulls. And it can bleed into early October too. And it comes down to the fact that all the cows have pretty much been bred. And just like the whitetail rut, and I equate this back to Thanksgiving, that Thanksgiving time period for the whitetail rut and the elk at the end of September going into the first few days of October, those big animals know that it's about over for the year, and they've got one last time to get it on. And sometimes that can be their biggest mistake. And I've called in a couple of my best bulls the last few years in time periods I never thought I'd see a bull. So little things like that. I'm just always tweaking and learning, and it's never ending. I mean, you're always learning something more. Just like that cough. Like, I killed a bull simply by recognizing what that sound was. It wasn't, you know, the usual sound of a bull bugling, but it was a deep-throated, hearty cough. And when I started running through all the critters right there that could make that, it came down to, no, that had to be a no.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great example. Well, Mark, thank you so much for taking the time and especially sharing all this information with us. Is there any way that our listeners can kind of follow along with your adventures or support your work in any way?
Well, they can send donations to me. No. they can go to markkaiser.com, MarkKayser, and the easiest way is go to markkayser.com and click on Facebook or Twitter. I do Facebook updates a couple times a week, if not more, and I do little stories about my hunts. So it's almost like going with me, except they're not pitching in gas, which they can do that if they want.
That goes back to the donation, right?
That's the donation part of it. But Facebook and Twitter are the two places that they can find me at, and it's real simple. I'm click right on it on markkayser.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Mark, for joining us.
I appreciate being invited to be here, Mark.